Jim picked out the best defensive position along the river bank. Here, a small tributary stream flowed down from the hills to join the main flow. It came in at an acute angle, forming a narrow wedge of ground bounded on one side by a pool of the main river. Jim plumbed the depth of the pool and found that it was deeper than a man was tall. "The Nguni will never swim," Tagwani assured him. "Water is perhaps the only thing they fear. They will eat neither fish nor hippopotamus, for they have an abhorrence of anything that comes from water."
"So the pool will protect our flank and rear," Jim was relieved.
Tagwani was proving a useful source of information. He boasted that he could speak the Nguni language fluently and that he knew their customs. If this was true, he was well worth his keep. Jim walked along the top of the steep bank of the tributary stream. The drop was over 10 feet, a wall of greasy clay that would be difficult to scale without a ladder.
"This will protect the other flank. We have only to draw up the wagons across the neck between the river and the stream."
They rolled them into position and roped the wheels together with rawhide rimps to prevent the Nguni pushing them aside and forcing a breach. In the gaps between the wagon bodies and under the wagon beds they packed thorn branches, leaving no space for the warriors to crawl through. In the centre of the wagon line they left a narrow gate. Jim ordered that the horses and the other domestic animals were to be herded and grazed close by, so that within minutes they could be driven into the protection of the laager, and the gateway sealed off against attack with faggots of thornbush placed ready to hand.
"Do you truly believe that the Nguni will return?"
Louisa tried to hide her fear as she asked the question.
"Don't you think that they might have learned by hard experience that they will pass us by?"
"Old Tagwani knows them well. He has no doubt that they will come, if only because they dearly love a fight," Jim replied.
"How many more of them are there?" she asked. "Does Tagwani know?"
"The old man cannot count. He says only that they are many."
Jim carefully measured and selected a spot well out in front of the wagons, where he made Small Boy and his drivers dig a shallow hole. In it he placed a 50-pound keg of coarse black gunpowder, set a fuse of slow match in the bunghole, and ran it back between the wheels of the centre wagon. He covered the keg with sacks of pebbles from the riverbed, which he hoped would scatter like musket balls when the keg exploded. He had the men cut firing loopholes into the wall of thorns through which they could lay down enfilading fire along the front of the defences. With the grindstone, Small Boy sharpened the naval cutlasses and placed them ready to hand. Then the loaded muskets were stacked beside the cutlasses with powder kegs and shot bags and spare ramrods close by. Louisa instructed and rehearsed the voorloopers and herd boys in loading and priming the weapons. She had some difficulty in persuading them that if one handful of gunpowder resulted in such a satisfactory explosion, two would be no improvement. It might result in a burst gun barrel or even the decapitation of whoever pulled the trigger. The water faggies were refilled from the river pool and made ready, either to slake the thirst of fighting men or to quench the flames if the Nguni latched on to the old trick of hurling lighted torches into the laager. Two herd boys were placed as lookouts on the crest of the low hill from which Louisa had first spied the charnel field. Jim gave them a clay firepot and ordered them to light a fire of green leaves if they saw the main Nguni impi, or warrior band, approaching. The smoke would warm the camp, and when it was lit, they could race down the hill into the laager to spread the alarm. Jim made certain that the boys came down from the hilltop and were safely in the laager each evening before nightfall. It would have been heartless to leave them out there in the dark at the mercy of wild beasts and Nguni scouts.
"The Nguni never attack at night," Tagwani told Jim. "They say that the darkness is for cowards. A true warrior should die only in the sunlight."
Nevertheless, Jim brought in his pickets and placed sentries around the periphery of the laager at nightfall and inspected them regularly during the night to make certain that they stayed awake.
"They will come singing and beating their shields," Tagwani said. "They wish to warn their enemy. They know that their fame precedes them, and that the sound of their voices and sight of their black headdresses fills the bellies of their enemy with fear."
"Then we must prepare a fitting greeting for them," Jim said. They cleared the trees and underbrush for 100 paces in front of the wagons, and the spans of trek oxen dragged away the felled trees. The ground was left open and bare. The attacking impi would have to cross this killing ground to reach the wagons. Then Jim paced out the distance in front of the defences and laid a line of white river stones to mark the most effective range and spread patterns of the goose shot. He impressed on his men that they must not open fire until the first rank of the attackers crossed this line. When he had completed all his preparations, they settled down to wait. This was the worst time, and the slow drag of the hours was corrosive to their spirits. Jim took advantage of this delay by spending time with Tegwani, learning more about the enemy from him. "Where do they keep their women and children?"
"They do not bring them to war. Perhaps they leave them in their homeland."
"Do they have a great store of plunder and riches?"
"Oh, they have many cattle, and they love the ivory teeth of the elephant and the hippopotamus."
"Tell me of their cattle."
"They have huge heads. The Nguni love their cattle like their own children. They do not slaughter them to eat their meat. Instead, they tap off their blood and mix it with the milk. This is their main food."
A calculating look came into Jim's eyes as he listened. A prime ox fetched 100 guilders in the colony. "Tell me of their ivory."
"They love ivory very much," Tegwani replied. "Perhaps they need it for trade with the Arabs of the north, or with the Bulamatari."
The name meant breakers of rock, a reference to the Portuguese whose prospectors chipped the reef for traces of gold. Jim was surprised that here in the deep interior Tegwani had heard of these nations. He questioned him on this, and Tegwani smiled.
My father's father knew of you crocodile wizards, and his father before him."
Jim nodded. It was naive of him. The Omani Arabs had been trading and slaving in Africa since the 5th century. It was 150 years ago that Vasco da Gama landed at Mozambique Island, and the Portuguese had begun building their forts and trading stations on the mainland. Of course, rumours of these events must have penetrated even to the most primitive tribes in the remotest corners of this vast land. Jim showed the old man the tusks of the bull he had killed, and Tegwani was amazed.
"Why? I have never seen teeth of this size before."
"Where do the Nguni find the ivory? Do they hunt the elephant?" Tegwani shook his head.
"Oh, the elephant is a mighty beast, and even the Nguni cannot kill him with their assegais."
"Where, then, does the ivory come from?"
"I have heard that there are some tribes who dig pits to trap them, or hang a spear weighted with stones in a tree over the pathway they frequent. When the elephant touches the trip rope, the spear drops and pierces him to the heart."
Tegwani paused and glanced at Bakat, who was asleep under one of the wagons.
"I have also heard that those little yellow monkeys of the San sometimes kill them with their poisoned arrows, but they can kill few by these methods."
"Then where do the Nguni get their ivory?" Jim persisted.
"Each season, especially in the time of the rains, some of the great beasts die of age or sickness, or they flounder in mud holes or fall from the mountain passes. The ivory tusks lie there for any man to gather up. During my lifetime, my own tribe has gathered up many."
"What happened to the tusks of your tribe?" Jim leaned forward eagerly.
"When they slaughtered our young men, the Nguni stole them from us, as they steal them from every tribe they attack and massacre."
"They must have a great store of ivory," Jim said. "Where do they keep it?"
"They carry it with them," Tegwani replied. "When they move, they load the tusks onto the backs of their cattle. They have as much ivory as they have cattle to carry it. They have many cattle."
Jim repeated the story to Louisa.
"I should like to find one of these herds, each beast with a fortune in ivory strapped to its back."
"Would it belong to you?" she asked innocently. "Spoils of war," he said, with righteous indignation. "Of course it would be mine." He looked to the hills over which he expected the impis of the Nguni to appear. "When will they come?" he wondered. The longer they had to wait, the more it played on all their nerves. Jim and Louisa passed much of the time over the chessboard, but when that palled, she painted his portrait again. While he posed for her, he read aloud Robinson Crusoe. It was his favourite book. Secretly, he saw himself as the resourceful hero. Although he had read it many times, he still chuckled and exclaimed at Crusoe's adventures, and bewailed his misfortunes. Two or three times during the day they rode out to inspect the lookouts on the hilltop and make sure the herd boys were awake and alert, and had not wandered off in search of honey or some other childish distraction. Then they scouted the lie of the land around the laager to make certain the Inguni pickets were not creeping up on them through the gullies and the light forests that were interspersed in the grassy veldt. On the 12th day after the massacre of the Bakwato, Jim and Louisa rode out alone. The herd boys on the hilltop were bored and disgruntled, and Jim had to speak to them sternly to make them stay at their posts. They came back down the hill and crossed the river at the ford. They rode out almost to the site of the massacre, but turned back before they reached it. Jim wanted to spare Louisa the harrowing memories associated with that place. They returned to within sight of the laager, and Jim stopped to examine the defences through the lenses of the telescope to see if he could pick out any weak spot he had overlooked. While he was preoccupied, Louisa dismounted and looked around for some place where she could go about her private business. The ground was open here, and the grass had been grazed down by the game herds until it reached only halfway to her knees. However, she saw that close by ran a donga, a natural gully cut out by the rainwaters draining towards the river. She handed Trueheart's reins to Jim. "I will not be gone long," she said, and started towards the gully. Jim opened his mouth to caution her, then thought better of it and looked away to preserve her modesty. As Louisa approached the lip of the gully, she became aware of a strange sound, a whisper, a susurration that seemed to tremble in the air. She kept on walking, but more slowly, puzzled but not alarmed. The sound grew louder, like running water or the hum of insects. She was not certain from which direction it came. She glanced back at Jim, but he was gazing through the lens, not looking in her direction. It was clear that he had not heard the sound. She hesitated, then stepped to the lip of the donga and looked down into it. As she did so, the sound rose to an angry buzz, as though she had disturbed a nest of hornets. The gully below her was closely packed with rank upon rank of Inguni warriors. They were sitting on their shields, but each man had his stabbing assegai in his right hand, and they were pointing the blades at her, and at the same time shaking the weapons, a slight trembling movement that agitated the war rattles on each wrist. This gave off the buzzing sound that had troubled her. The small movement also set the glossy black feathers in their headdresses dancing. Their naked torsos were anointed with fat so that they shone like washed coal. The whites of their eyes staring up at her were the only contrast in the seething expanse of black. It seemed to Louisa that she was gazing down on an enormous dragon coiled in its lair, black scales glittering, angry and venomous, poised to strike. She whirled and ran. "Jim! Beware! They are here!" Jim looked back, startled by her cry. He saw no sign of danger, only Louisa racing towards him with her face working with terror. "What is it?" he called. And at that moment the ground seemed to open behind the running girl, and from it erupted a mass of warriors. Their bare feet beat upon the hard earth, and the war rattles on their ankles crashed in unison. They drummed on their black war shields with the assegais, a deafening roar, and they shouted, "Bulala, Bulala, Amagati, kill, kill the wizards!" Louisa fled before this rolling tide. She ran like a whippet, nimble and quick, but one of her pursuers was quicker still. He was tall and lean, made taller by the headdress. The muscles started proud in his belly and shoulders as he bounded after her. He threw aside his shield to unburden himself. Although Louisa had a lead of 20 paces or more, he was overhauling her swiftly. The haft of his assegai rested lightly on his shoulder, but the long blade was pointed forward, poised for the thrust between her shoulder blades. Jim had a fleeting memory of the Bakwato girl, run through in this way, the blade appearing magically out of the middle of her breast, smeared pink with her heart's blood. He sent Drumfire into full gallop, and dragging Trueheart on the rein behind him, raced to meet Louisa. But he saw that the leading warrior was already too close. She would not have time to mount before he was on her, his blade transfixed through her body. He did not slow or check Drumfire's charge. They brushed past Louisa so closely that her hair fluttered in the wind on their passing. Jim tossed her Trueheart's reins. "Get up and away!" he shouted as he went by. He had only one musket with him, for he had not expected a fight. He could not afford to waste that single shot. The light ball of the pistol might only wound and not kill cleanly. There was no latitude for error here. He had seen the warrior throw aside his shield. He jerked the naval cutlass from its scabbard. Under the eye of Aberley and his father, he had practiced with this weapon until he mastered the manual of arms. He did not brandish the blade to warn this man. He charged Drumfire straight at the Nguni and saw him check and change his grip on the assegai, his dark eyes locked on Jim's face. Jim knew by his haughty expression that he would not deign to wound the horse under him, but would take him on man to man. He watched for the assegai thrust, leaning forward to meet it. The Nguni struck, and Jim dropped the cutlass into the classic canter, sweeping aside the point of the assegai, then reversed, and, as he passed, he swung the cutlass backhanded. Small boy had put a fine edge on the steel, and it was sharp as a butcher's cleaver. Jim swept it across the back of the warrior's neck, and felt the hilt jar in his hand as it sheared cleanly through his vertebra. The man dropped as though a gallows trap had opened under him. At the pressure of his knees, Drumfire spun round like a weathercock in a fluke of wind. He saw that Louisa was having difficulty trying to mount Trueheart. The mare had smelt the Nguni and seen the ranks racing towards them. She was skittering sideways and throwing her head wildly. Holding on to the reins, Louisa was being pulled off her feet. Jim sheathed the bloody cutlass and turned Drumfire in behind her. Leaning from the saddle, he grabbed a handful of the baggy seat of her breeches and boosted her up into the saddle. Then he steadied her with her hand on her arm as they galloped back knee to knee. As soon as they were clear, he drew his pistol and fired a shot into the air to alert the sentries at the laager. As soon as he saw that they had heard it, he told Louisa, "Ride back. Warn them to get the animals into the laager. Send Buckut and Smallboy to help me delay them." To his relief, she had the good sense not to argue and raced away, pushing Trueheart to the top of her speed. He turned back to face the charging warriors, drew the musket from its sheath and walked Drumfire towards them. He picked out the Induna in the front rank, who was leading them. Tegwani had told him how to recognize the captains. "They are always older men, and they wear ostrich plumes in their headdress and white cowtails on their arms." He touched Drumfire with his toes and broke into a trot, heading directly for the Induna. By now the Nguni must have understood the terrible menace of the firearms, but the man showed no fear. He increased the speed of his charge and lifted his shield to clear his spear arm, his face twisted with the ferocity of his war cry, "Bulala! Kill! Kill!" Behind him his men surged forward. Jim let him come in close, then fired. Still at full run, the Induna went down. The assegai flew from his hand and he rolled in the grass. The spread of shot caught the two men directly behind him and sent them tumbling too. An angry roar went up from the black mass of the Impi to see their captain and their comrades shot down. But Jim had wheeled away and was already galloping back to reload. The Nguni could not keep up the pace, and they slowed to a trot. But still they came on. With the musket reloaded, Jim mounted again and rode to meet them. He wondered how many there were in that dark mass, but it was impossible to guess. He crossed their front at less than 20 paces and fired into them. He saw men stumble and fall, but their comrades swept over them so their bodies were hidden almost immediately. This time there was no angry shout to acknowledge the damage he had inflicted. The Impi slowed to a smooth swinging trot and began to sing. The deep African voices were beautiful, but the sound made the hair rise on the back of Jim's neck and seemed to reverberate deep in his guts. They moved inexorably towards the fortified walls of the laager. As Jim finished reloading again, he heard the sound of hoofs and looked up to see Buckut and Louisa leading Zama and the other drivers out through the gateway between the wagons. "Lord, give me strength. I meant us to stay safely in the laager," he muttered. But then he made the best of it. As she rode up and handed him his second musket, he said, "The same drill as before, Hedgehog. You take command of the second section. Zama, Buckut and Muntu with you. Smallboy and Class with me." He led his section in, right under the assegais of the front rank of warriors, and they fired the first guns, then changed, came back, and fired the second volley, before breaking off and galloping back with empty guns. "Pick out the Indunas," Jim called, "Kill their captains!" as Louisa led her section forward. Again and again the two sections changed places smoothly, and the steady volleys never faltered. Jim saw with grim satisfaction that most of the Indunas at the front of the attack had fallen under the onslaught. The Nguni wilted before this fearsome, unrelenting attack. Their pace slowed. The singing sank away to an angry, frustrated hissing. At last they stopped, only 300 paces short of the laager. The horsemen kept up the steady attack. Jim rode in once again at the head of his section and saw the change. Some of the warriors in the front rank lowered their shields and glanced behind them. Jim and his men fired a volley with their first guns, then turned and rode back along the front with their second guns at the ready. The headdresses waved, the feathers fluttered like the wind in the grass. The next volley crashed into them, and the lead shot clapped into living flesh. Men reeled and fell. The echoes of the volley were still booming back from the hills when Louisa galloped forward with Zama, Bucket, and Muntu close behind her. The front rank of the Nguni saw them coming and broke. They turned back and shoved with their shields into the men behind them, shouting, "Emuva! Back! Go back!" But those behind shouted, "Shikalela! Forward! Push forward!" The entire impi wavered, swaying back and forth, men struggling, their shields tangling and blocking each other's spear arms. Louisa and her men charged in close, and they fired a rolling volley into the struggling mass. A groan of despair went up, and the rear rank gave way. They turned and streamed back across the grassland, leaving their dead and wounded lying where they had fallen, their shields, spears, and kerries strewn about them. Louisa's party galloped after them, firing their second guns into the ruck. Jim saw the danger of them being drawn into a trap and raced after them. Drumfire swiftly overhauled them. "Stop! Break off the chase!" Louisa obeyed at once and called off her men. All of them rode back. As soon as they were safely into the laager, a span of oxen dragged the faggots of thornbush into the gap in the defences to seal it off. It seemed impossible that such a mass of humanity could disappear so swiftly. But by the time the gate was secured, the impi was gone, and the only signs of the fighting were the dead and the trampled, blood-stained grass in front of the laager. "We hurt them grievously. Will they come back?" Louisa asked anxiously. "As surely as the sun will set and rise again tomorrow," Jim said grimly, and nodded to where it was already sinking towards the horizon. "That was probably only the scouting party sent by Manatasi to test our mettle." He called for Tegwani, and the old man came at once, trying not to favour his wounds. The impi were lying up close to the laager. "If Welanga had not come across them, they would have waited for nightfall to attack us. You were wrong, old man. They do fight at night."
"Only the Ukulukulu is never wrong," Tegwani answered, with an unconvincing attempt at nonchalance. "You can redeem yourself," Jim told him sternly. "I will do whatever you say," Tegwani nodded.
"Some of the Nguni are not dead. As we rode back, I saw at least one still moving. Go out with Bakat to guard you. Find one of the Nguni who still lives. I want to know the whereabouts of their queen. I also want to know where their baggage train is camped, the cattle and the ivory." Tegwani nodded and loosened his skinning knife in its sheath. Jim was about to order him to leave his knife in the laager, but then he remembered the women and children of the old man's tribe and the manner of their deaths. "Go at once, great chief. Go before the coming of darkness and before the hyena find the wounded Nguni." Then he turned to Bakat. "Have your musket ready. Never trust an Nguni, especially a dead one." Three times Jim looked up from inspecting the defences of the laager at the sound of Bakat's musket booming out across the battlefield. He knew that the little bushman was finishing off the wounded enemy. Just as the light was fading, Bakat and Tegwani returned to the laager. Both were carrying assegais and looted ivory ornaments. Tegwani had fresh blood on his hands.
"I spoke to a wounded Induna before he died. You were right. This was only a scouting party. However, Manatasi is very close with the rest of her impis and the cattle. She will be here within 2 days." What did you do with the man who told you this?
I recognized him, Tegwani replied. He was the one who led the first attack on our village. Two of my sons died that day.
Tegwani was silent for a while, then smiled thinly.
It would have been heartless to leave a fine warrior such as he was to the hyenas. I am a man of compassion.